This is tape two, side one, still talking to Halsey Reinhardt on November 14, 1984. Talking about John Marshall, and you're describing what he looked like.
John and Liz were pioneers, and they were dressed like pioneers. As I mentioned, John had a gray beard, and Liz wore the general long skirts of the old pioneers. The reason I mention them is that they show a relationship of pioneering to the history. Some of the people called John Old Black Hawk. He was a great old hunter, and I said one time, well, why do you call him Black Hawk? And he said, well, he says that his father was one of the militia who chased Black Hawk through this area. And when he going through here, he saw this beautiful spring. And when it came time to come in and settle the area, this is where he searched out. So there is a connection between the Black Hawk War and the settlement in Richland County.
Where is that spring?
Oh, it's a mile and a half across the hills over here. Yeah. Spring water is one of the things, of course, that brought the pioneers in. They had lived down in Indiana, and they lived down in Illinois, and they had open wells. Grandpa used to tell me as a boy how where they lived in Indiana before they moved to Richland City, Wisconsin, they had a pickerel in the well. And the pickerel, his main purpose in life down there was to pick up the bugs that fell in the well. It was better to drink after a pickerel than it was to drink after all the dead bugs that fell in the well. But these people had so much malaria that to coming back here, they looked for timber and they looked for farmland, but primarily they looked for good water. We have no concept of the fear of death that was an everyday part of pioneer life. Without medical help and without vaccination and without the general sulfas and that sort of thing that we use currently, aspirins and all the things that we take, how fragile life was. We look at our life now as being fragile, but bacillus of some kind, typhoid or diphtheria, an epidemic would break out and take whole families. And so when they could find one of the things and get pure water, this was one of the great assets of living. This is one of the things that brought them in. Well, this is one of the amusing stories, and of course isn't for giving this story in the parlor, but Grandpa and Newt sat over here, two old men, both with gray beards, and they'd sit there, and one of them would tell a story, and then the other would tell a story. In fact, I have the picture mark of these two old men sitting there telling stories to each other and recounting Civil War episodes. And the one that I remember was that Newt says, Sile, do you remember that Johnny Reb that we sneaked up on our camp one and the sentry wounded him? And Grandpa said, yes, Newt, I remember him. And Newt said, yeah, we brought him into camp and he was hurt bad. He was really hurt bad. And Grandpa said, I felt awful sorry for him. And he said, well, we did the best we could for him. And Grandpa said, yes, he said, we gave him the best that we could. And Newt said, yes, he said, we laid him out there on beside the fire and put a blanket over him. And he said, Newt said, all at once he just straightened out and farted. A little pause. Newt says, 'twas the last breath he ever drew. I didn't know whether you wanted that one or not, Mark.
Well, let's go on with stories about the Civil War. You remember seeing your grandfather or Newt up here at the store in Rockbridge? Do you remember any of the other stories they told about the Civil War?
No, I don't remember very many of them because largely the Civil War veterans were going quite rapidly. I think I have told you the story of the Civil War. The thing that happened up here in the Sayersville area, didn't I?
I'd love to have that on tape again.
Would you like to have that? Well, this may be a fictitious story, although it's certainly it's, could have happened. My friend Leslie Hendricks told me of his grandfather, Bill Holbrook, who in about 1924 got drunk and told him this story. And then in 1938 got to drinking again and told him the same story. So how can you better authenticate a story than when a man who will get drunk 24 years apart and tell the same story, identical. So that must be certainly three strikes for the truth at that point. But we have up here the little village of Sayersville, which is nothing there now, not even a white spot in the road. But every pioneer who came in would decide that maybe my crossroads will be the crossroads that will be the deciding point for a little village, or maybe even a city might be developed there. Everybody was looking for that, so if that possibility arose, they could sublet their land and divide it and so forth, sell it off for lots, and it was always the Yankee ingenuity of making everything count. Anyway, Mr. Sayers came up at Sayersville and platted out the town of Sayersville. He was the postmaster. And during the Civil War, most of the young men were going off to war, and Mr. Sayers was still living there at the post office. And right next to him was a farm that was owned by a family that we'll call Johnsons. And Mr. Johnson had gone to the war and left his wife, Mrs. Johnson, and the family to look after the farm. Apparently, Mr. Sayers coveted this farm. He wanted to buy it, and he tried to buy it of Mrs. Johnson several times, but she said no, that she wanted to keep the farm so that when her husband came back from the war, that they would be able to take up their life where he had left it off and go on farming the farm. So Mr. Sayers had a very insidious and devious idea. Being in the post office, he forged a letter from the War Department to Mrs. Johnson saying that they grievously had to report that her husband had been killed in action at Shiloh and wouldn't be coming back from the war, and she would receive back in some due time his personal effects and the things that would garner would be of value to her. And so then Mr. Sayers, delivering the letter, said, well, I would just be glad to take the farm off your hands, and you could go back to Indiana where your parents live and back to your own people. So he traded her a horse and a little money, and Mrs. Johnson headed back to Indiana on the horse. Well, the war was over, and when the soldiers started coming back, just drifting back into the valley, who came back but Mr. Johnson? And immediately people found what had happened. They easily surmised that Mr. Sayers had forged this letter and had sent her erroneously back to Indiana. So they stopped Mr. Johnson before he got home and explained to him what the situation was and that his wife wasn't there. But they got him involved in their intrigue. So by secreting him and telling him not to become a public figure until the right time come, they went to Mr. Sayers and said, well, we have a man who wants to buy your farm. And he said he'd be over there at 6 o'clock tonight. Well, then all the old soldiers put on their uniforms. And when Mr. Sayers appeared over at the farm, why, here were all of the buddies and Mr. Johnson. Immediately, Mr. Sayers assumed what had happened, that he had been found out, and they simply were in no mood for pleas of sympathy. They held a court-martial and drummed him out of the service and executed him on the spot and buried him, took his horse, and took his horse way over beyond Bloom City and tied him up in the brush. Well, their thinking was that the horse would remain tied for a couple of days and would jerk his bridle loose from his head or break it, the reins that were tied up with. And the horse came back home, and they said, well, Mr. Sayers has left the country. He's probably headed for North Dakota or South Dakota or somewhere. And this is the assumption was that then that Mr. Sayers had gone when actually he had been executed and had been buried in a wooden box. Now, whether there's any truth to this story or not, I don't know, but a couple of fellows who were friends of mine, Don McNamer and Merton Watts, were hunting in that area, and there was a hole in the ground where an animal had run in that they were pursuing, and they dug to try to dig the animal out, and they dug out the remains of an old box where somebody had been buried. So the chances are, the possibilities are that this was a true story. Whether it was or not, I don't know.
This is over the old Johnson farm, and what was in the box?
The box was rotted. It seemed like there were some pieces of cloth in the box, like it might have been a flag or clothing. There were the metal, a couple of hinges. There was nothing to indicate a body had been there. But of course, this was 40 and 70 years afterwards, so the chances of any trace of the body remaining would be very limited. So I'm not sure which is the best authentication of the story, the fact that they found the box, or the fact that Pap Holbrook sold the same story as drinking at long intervals.
What did the neighbors talk about when you'd go by to visit of an evening? What were some of the events of this neighborhood that used to stand out in people's minds?
Well, the most
characters were them.
The most interesting thing, of course, that happened was that once in a while some neighbor would feel affluent enough to buy either a piano or a phonograph. And of course the telephone was a great source of comfort, because they were single wire circuits, and every magneto operated telephone, you had to turn the crank to get the signals. And people did a great deal of conversing back and forth on the telephone. But when the first phonographs came out, Dad didn't really feel affluent enough to own a phonograph, but our friends over at Hub City, Arthur and Prudy Weller, had a phonograph with the cylindrical records, the little cylinders that you put on. And of course, one of the records that was most, one of the characters that was most familiar with everybody was Uncle Josh. Have you heard the Uncle Josh record? Well, Uncle Josh was the fellow who told the story, and there were a new Uncle Josh record came out every month or two, and people would collect all of them, and they would go over them. Uncle Josh told about how he got his first automobile, and he took his first automobile right out in the back of the house, and he rode around and around and around the house trying to figure out some way to get the automobile stopped. And I remember one of the things that he said as he went around the corner of the house, he said, well, Mirandy, my life insurance is in the top drawer of the dresser. But the Uncle Josh records were very familiar to everybody. Phonographs were one of the forerunners. Of course, then as radio came in starting in about 1928. The first radios that were around were well, weren't even called radios. They were called wireless telephones, and they were crystal sets. I well remember when people talked about Hugh McNally having a wireless telephone. Well, it was there were two disadvantages to having one. One was that it didn't have any power to get anywhere. The other was that there were only two or three stations available. There was in Chicago, there was broadcasting and KMOX, St. Louis, Missouri, and W.C. Fields Seed Company had a radio station in Iowa. And if you were had a real good receiver, you could get Pittsburgh. But there weren't that many stations. The first radios were multiple dial. You had a six tube set, and it would have so many condensers. But rather than having them all synchronized, so you could turn one button and all the condensers would all revolve and get to the right place together, you had to adjust each one across as it went. And some of the most ungodly sounds came out of those radios. Of course, the first one that I heard was built by Oscar Henry, who was a garageman and electrician down at Richland Center. And I suppose he bought it as a kit and assembled it. Rather than putting it in a box, it was assembled sort of into the side of the kitchen wall. And it had about five dials that you had to synchronize each to, if you move this one a little, you'd have to move this one a little too, in order to make them come together. And you could use about three sets of headphones on it. There were no loudspeakers. You had to be listening to the broadcast through headphones. Then the first speakers that came out were the big horns. And then a later way, the cone speaker came out. Grandma bought hers in 1928, and we got it installed just in time to get the reports on the Herbert Hoover, Al Smith election, when Herbert Hoover beat Al Smith in 1928.
I promised
them that
when she came
home. Well, yes, it was. When one family in a locality had a radio, it was just one step farther than one family in the locality having a phonograph. Everybody seemed together, although there was the matter of the radio just reaching out to the living world, and the phonograph bringing in the canned world, which somebody had carefully edited and produced. But the living world was the world of the radio, and it reached out to the current events of the time. And that one that I remember was the... I remember when we got our first radio. Old Charlie Strang in Richland Center was the sold Crosley radios, and Grandma decided to buy one, and if Charlie would get it out there before the election night. Well, Charlie was a little slow getting out there, and when he got out, it was about 9 o'clock. Well, the first thing you had to do to have a radio was to put up an antenna. Yeah, you had to have your wire was at least a 50 or 60 or 70 foot copper wire with a lead in that you had to get up, and you had to get it up, at least 20 feet off of the ground to pick up the signals that were coming in. And Charlie was just like a squirrel. He went right up on top of the roof in the dark, and we fastened one end of it down on the barn, and Charlie ran up the other end, ran up the ladder, ran right up the roof. And there he sat up on the roof, and he pulled the wire tight and ran the lead-in wire down, and we brought it in, and you could just almost hold your breath. And he brought in the batteries. First was the big A battery. And then there were the 3B batteries. And then there were the 2C batteries. And then there was the D battery. You put those all together, and you wired one to the other. And it was a maze of wiring, to get everything hooked up. And then you turn the switch, and you turn the dials. And by golly, there it came in. And you think, this is, this, no, never can they do anything that supersedes this. This just must be the very last word of the last word. There, nothing can ever be better than this. Some of the things that we heard were the Glico Club Eskimos, were some of the big name bands. There were the dramas that came in over the radio were so well done, you could just almost. And then there were serials that ran. Fibber McGee, of course, and Molly, and some of the radio serials that were reading. This meant a lot, and if only one family in a locality had them, why other people would, they had lots of friends. They had lots of company people coming in to listen. Then as radios began to get cheaper, and they began to cut down the numbers of batteries, and of course, then in 1938, the REA came through, and we had 110-volt electricity. Everything became relatively new and easy to acquire, and so it was a long time before somebody had a television set. We were at the State Fair at Milwaukee, and they were broadcasting downtown Milwaukee and picking it up out to the fairground. I remember standing in front of the television screen, which was a circular screen, probably 12 inches across, and seeing the picture that was being broadcast from downtown Milwaukee out to the state fairgrounds. In 1933, at the General Electric exhibit in Chicago, they were dramatizing the picture and producing it at one end of the hall, and there were seats at the other end of the screen, and you sat at the other end and you could look around the screen and see where they were producing it down at the other end of the hall. And that was the extent of television at that time.
What year was that?
33. And the way that was being done was differently than having the picture tube and so forth as we have now. There was a large circular disc in which holes spiraled out from the center to the outside. And the photoelectric cell would give an intensity of light, either light or dark, and it would shine through the holes as the spirals went around. At the other end was a similar spiral and a similar bulb in which there was either light strength or weakness of light. And the process was to keep these two circulating discs going at the same speed around so that the light would be shining through a similar hole in this disc as it was in the producing disc, and that light was shining on a screen, and it had to revolve fast enough that those lights and darks of the light, the retention of your eye, would combine that into being a picture. Can you imagine anything being as primitive as this? And yet this was 1933 television. And
what about other neighborhood events?
Well, of course, the big deal of the year, of course, was the school program. And you weren't a good teacher if you didn't produce a good program. And everybody was involved in the school. Everybody spoke their piece. And as the producer, which the teacher was, I was an actor while I was in school. And then I was the producer while I taught school. And you did a lot of work in making it. You had probably two or three, as were called, dialogues, which were very short skits, dramatic skits, and then you probably had several songs, The first grade, first and second and third grade would probably have their song, and maybe the whole school would have a song. And most everybody had to, as we said, speak a piece, which was a piece of poetry of some kind, and or a recitation of, not necessarily poetic, but mostly was very dramatic or humorous. And it was a breathtaking experience to have the stage crew and you would rig up the schoolhouse with a curtain that could be raised and lowered.
Remember a specific program, one that stands out in your mind? An anecdote about it, getting ready frantically, or somebody forgetting something?
Well, of course that I can remember one that stands out in my mind, because Gyneth was the producer, and I went to her school program. I think that's probably when I decided I was going to marry her. She didn't know that, but I went to that school program at the kids' school. I remember that particular one. I remember the ones that I helped put on. We sometimes had our programs in the old Odd Fellows Hall, and then later we had them in the community building. It was much easier. You didn't have to disrupt the school. There were quite a great deal of difference in the attitude of teachers. Some teachers didn't want to have a program at all. They didn't want to go to that extra length of work, because it was a lot of hard work. But other teachers liked to do nothing else but, so they'd have two or three a year. And the people in the school district, if you didn't have a program, they were critical. But if you had two or three a year, they thought, well, you're getting away from the 3 hours and having a dramatic show when you should be teaching reading, writing, and arithmetic. So that becomes a part of the history of that.
House dances, do you remember those at all?
Oh, we had parties.
House parties?
House parties.
What was that like?
Oh, yes. Having that single child syndrome, I didn't respond to those very well. I went to parties and liked to go, but as far as playing party games, I just simply didn't really respond to that very much. I don't know just what I did want to do. Sit and tell stories, I guess. But there would be Skip Kamaloo and some of those that... But I wasn't very heavily involved.
Okay, this is take two, side two, okay?
Yes, a part of the program usually was to make money. I don't know what we're making money for in the schools. Well, yes, we do. We usually bought something with the money. There usually was a project. Either you bought a picture, or you bought a painting set, or you bought some musical instrument or something that was a part of the school. And as a good teacher, while you were donating your efforts to producing something for the school that might remain there many years. But they often had box socials. And this is when all the eligible girls and women would bring in a box lunch, cakes, pies, all the bits that would go into the box lunch. And then they would be auctioned off. And, of course, then you got to eat your supper with whoever had prepared the box that you bought. And if your girlfriend happened to take a box there and somebody else found out whose that was, they would start to run the price up on you. And those prices got quite phenomenal for the time sometimes. And once in a while, a guy just couldn't cut it. He couldn't hack it any longer, and he'd have to let somebody else buy his girlfriend's box. And of course, this was all part of the gag. It increased the price of the box. And there were also the same thing with pies. It would have just simply a pie supper, and you bought the pie and you went and ate pie with the girl who produced the pie. And then, of course, it was a little hard to consume a whole pie, so you carried the rest of it with you home for breakfast. And this is one of the interesting parts of it. One of the things that always seemed like you accumulated such crowds of people. People were anxious for things to go to, and a great and great many people would come. And of course, you talk about a barn raising, and when you had, this was similar to the thrashing time, though, when it was just a matter of everybody getting together and working together and accomplishing something together. It's the spirit of the border, I guess. I think one of the things that shouldn't be glossed over at this point, though, is the camp meetings. Those were real killer dealers sometimes, because some of those evangelists were real dramatists. I tell you, the Lord himself must have envied some of those fellows the way they could bring the word of the Lord out in vocal giving stories. We had one man who was, I think, was a born actor, maybe had been a professional actor, and that was Reverend Bowman. He just strode up and down the platform, and he was the devil as he went up, and he was God when he came back down. He dramatized everything so beautifully, and there was a great deal of hypnosis. Though the real dramatists would have them in the aisles, and of course they used to talk about the holy rollers, the one who got so excited that they jumped up and they ran out to the woods and came back and came to the tent. Then there used to be a little antagonism, too, between sometimes the local churches weren't too happy to have a different denomination come in and hold revival meetings in their bailiwick. And so there would be, once in a while, somebody would cut the ropes and drop the tent in on the revival. Those things happened. Some of the real good fights took place outside the revivals. I well remember one revival that we went to, and a man was catcalling in to the revivalists, and one of the local good upright Christian citizens went out and whacked him on the head with a pair of pliers or something, and changed his life. This guy who had always created uproar wherever he went, never created any more uproar. He was a good citizen after that, because he came so close to death that he could even speak with God from his vantage point. When he came back, he was a good boy from then on. He saw the light. It may have come with a bump, but he saw the light anyway.
Let's just be real specific about a camp meeting. One that you remember. Where's the tent? It was set up at so and
so. Oh, the tent was set. The tent was.
Let's see it. How long is it there? Go into detail. Remember who's the usher. Remember one night when you got there, when it rained, or what happened in the windstorm. I've got all the time in the world. If we just do one camp meeting, the rest of this tape,
well,
we can come back another time for the rest.
I guess the one that I remember best was Driscoll and Eads. And they set up their tent in the schoolyard up at Rockbridge. And Driscoll was the evangelist, and he was a dramatist. And I had more fear then of the world coming to an end before Saturday night than I have right now of the atomic oblivion. And I have lain in bed and shivered and shaken after one of his sermons, so frightened that the world is coming to an end, and you have to be right with God, and you go over in your mind, gee, am I right with God? I better be getting, if I am not right, I better be finding the right words. That's all. God, here I am. Don't bring it on without getting me over the line. And you could, then if there happened to be a thunderstorm or something come up, you would just be certain that this is the very end. This has got to be the end of the world. Of course, the objective of the evangelist is to get people to come forward and to give their lives to Christ. And the more people that he can get to come forward, why, the better he feels that his matter has been. Of course, what he may not know is that he's got all the same people who came forward to his camp meeting who just came forward to the last camp meeting that were there 6 weeks ago. But anyway, the numbers count up in pretty good shape. And of course, then one of the things is to raise money to get in the one that I remember in particular at the schoolhouse. Driscoll was the dramatist. He was the evangelist who brought down the fires of hell on earth and scared the living hell out of a lot of people. But Eads was the song leader and was a beautiful song leader. Did such a tremendously good job, was probably would have been or may have been sometime a good choir leader. The one that I got most interested in was one that was held in the community building. And, oh, I'm searching for his name. The boy evangelist, he was 18 years old. And all the kids in the community turned out, and he mesmerized us all. He had us all coming to the Lord, and it was nothing humorous about it. It was all in serious concept. There was no kidding at all. He was very serious, and I'm sure that the commitment that people made in their lives, because I and then following him, he was there for a couple of weeks, and there was a Baptist minister named Reverend Sproul came over from Baraboo and had a week service following this boy evangelist service. I don't know whether his attitude was to kind of put a little more reality in what this boy evangelist had said or not, but I found this man the man that I really envied. He was a very highly educated man, a good speaker, a very kind man, and I admired him so much. I admired him an awful lot more one day when he came driving in, and he was driving a brand new Studebaker. And we said, "Well, that's a nice car you have there." And he said, "Yes, my congregation got together and raised the money and brought me this new Studebaker." I thought, boy, oh boy, right then, I'm going to be a preacher. But I think at that time I was inclined to perhaps be involved in the ministry, because Reverend Sproul was such an enviable man, very serious, and new Studebakers, nice to have too.
Were there any denominations that were against camp meetings? Was there any conflicts that were created because camp meetings were brought in?
Oh yes, there were. I don't know the specifics of them. I do know that over at Gillingham, somebody burned the tent simply after the service was over. And there was a lot of question about that. One of the things that I might talk about here, Mark, that happened in this community was the coming of the Ku Klux Klan. And this looks a little humorous from a distance, but it was deadly serious at the time. The Klansmen were so super patriotic, and God, home, and America, that they were dangerous. And the insidious thing about it was that they were for all the good things, but they want all the good things for just us. No blacks, no Jews, no Catholics. They aren't Americans. We're the only true Americans. And they involve people that I guess have made me a little skeptical of organizations ever since, because even my old good friend Reverend Hatch became a Ku Klux Klan member, and my dad had joined the Ku Klux Klan. And in our area, the main purpose of the Ku Klux Klan was to antagonize a couple families of Catholics that lived up the road. And I could go back on our rocks on our point of our hill, and I'm not sure that I could still find the remnants, but I could find the exact place, and the remnants laid there for years of a great big cross, fiery cross, that was burned on top of our hill so that it would shine up the valley where these two Catholic families lived. And the people who did it were not Christian people. They were people who had had an antagonism with these Catholics off and on all their life, clear back to the days that they went to school. And yet now they were getting some support, and they were going to terrify these people with the crosses that they burned. And it was a tragic thing. I can remember being in the community building when the Catholic, or when the Ku Klux Klan came in their white robes and carrying the cross. It's an insidious kind of thing that spread from the South up here and was really dangerous. And it's danger that type of attitude can spread through a community. And you see it starting up. Fortunately, in America, we're broad-minded enough that thus far we have put that sort of thing down, but I'm not sure we'll always be able to.
What's the time frame of when this happened, when they first came in, and when did it die out, and how did it die out, and some more incidents?
Well,
I've not heard about it all.
It came in a, I would guess, 1923 or 1924, about that period. And it came, actually, these superheated evangelists were the ones that reaching out for a broader base to come from, involving super patriotism along with their very, very fundamentalist Christian beliefs, forged together this philosophy of the Ku Klux Klan, which was America first, the super patriot. And I guess it got to the point of a certain amount of ridicule and a certain amount of reassessment of the positions that people were in, and looking at the positions and the attitudes, people began to see through that it really was a money-making thing for some people. There were some people who were promoters who were really making money out of it. But it covered quite a broad base, I think, don't you, Gaia?
I was pretty young.
Well, they were quite strong here and in Richland Center. In fact,
until
it probably lasted for 4 years, and then it just simply died away.
Do you remember anything else? You remember the cross up there in your on the rock? Do you remember any other incidents?
No, I don't remember. Only going to the meetings and having the Klansmen come marching in. The ones from Richland Center would all come out and join the ones at Rockbridge, and they would stand around the front of the community building and in their white robes and their faces covered, until you would be guessing who they were. You didn't have to guess long. You knew about who everybody was. Dad never had nerve enough to own a robe or put it on, but there were a lot of non-participating members. There were those, I could name some names of the people who were the participating members, who really liked to enjoy a good fight. And then there were the non-participating ones who believed, well, after all, home God and mother can't be wrong. And so we'll join up and follow through on it. But that's a part of history that not very much is written about. shut your mic. You're just a second.